My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest edition of My Classic Album, the show where we look back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris and I've really been looking forward to this episode of My Classic Album as we're looking at one of my favourite bands of all time and one of my favourite albums of all time. Today we are talking about Metallica, the 1991 self-titled album from one of the biggest bands in the world, one of the biggest metal bands of all time. Very excited, we're finally touching on Metallica, and my special guest, Calvin Lever, guitarist with the band Night Screamer, who chose the album, will be coming up in just a little bit to chat with me about, you know, it really is. We've been doing some great albums lately, but for me, the Black Album is up there, one of the greatest albums of all time. And I say to Calvin during the conversation, for me, it is a toss-up between Master of Puppets and the Black Album as to my favourite Metallica album. And hopefully we'll do both before this podcast is all said and done. But at least we're doing one of them today. Very, very excited. For those who are maybe casual Metallica fans, maybe people who just know the big songs, you know, the majority of them are on this album. Enter Sandman, Sad But True, Nothing Else Matters, The Unforgiven. I could go on. It's just a great, great album, and I can't wait for you to hear my chat with Calvin that is coming up in just a little bit. Sometimes I have a few things that I want to talk about, but I'm just going to dive straight in pretty much. I just wanted to let you guys know about an episode that's coming up in a few months' time that I would like a bit of help with, if possible. So long-time listeners to the show will know that we have often done anniversary editions when the big classic albums are coming up to a significant anniversary. So far, we celebrated 40 years of Rumours by Fleetwood Mac, we celebrated 30 years of Hysteria by Def Leppard, and we did 40 years of Bat Out of Hell. They were all back in 2017. So far this year, and indeed last year, we haven't touched on any of the anniversaries of any of the big albums, but I'm planning to change that. In November of this year, The Wall by Pink Floyd will be 40 years old. And for me, it is an awesome album. It's one of the best-selling albums of all time. It's got a real cult following. You know, it's a really fascinating album, not just in the album itself, but kind of the reasons why it was produced and all the things that I love doing this podcast about, you can apply to The Wall. You know, it's got such an incredible story and I can't wait to celebrate 40 years of it. And I'm just reaching out for anyone who would like to get involved. It could be something as simple as sending me your thoughts on the album, which you can do through any of our social media pages. So if you get yourself onto our Facebook page, My Classic Album with Mike Norris, and feel free to send me a message or post there your thoughts, well, on anything really, but particularly in this instance, on The Wall. If you get yourself to Instagram and follow us on My Classic Album Podcast, and again, you can private message me there and I'll happily respond as soon as I can. And you can follow us on Twitter at @MCA_podcast. And all of this information is up on our website, www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. Similarly, if you are a musician, and I know a lot of musicians and singer-songwriters and stuff listen to the podcast, and that's how often they get in touch with me and appear on the show. If you're listening and The Wall is one of your classic albums, and you would like to chat with me on the show about it, I haven't quite decided how this is going to be yet. I'm aware it's a double album. There's the potential that we might be doing two episodes dedicated, one to each disc of The Wall. So potentially, if I have two people get involved, it may be that we split the album in half. It may be that I have one guy who I'm just going to talk to about the whole album. If you want to get involved and you would like to chat about The Wall, absolutely get in touch. and we'll have a chat about that. There's plenty of time because the anniversary isn't till November, but with these anniversary ones, I really like to get a good start on things, which is why I'm talking about it now. And similarly, if anyone knows anyone who has a link to the album, so when we've done these anniversary episodes in the past, I've been very lucky that on a couple of occasions, we've been able to speak to people who were directly involved in the production of the album. So when we did the Rumours episode, Ken Calais came on and he chatted about his experience being the producer and engineer of Rumours and the ramifications of that, which was just so fascinating. And I was very lucky to chat with Ellen Foley, who sang Paradise by the Dashboard Light on the Battle of Hell album with Meatloaf. And again, her stories about her career and the production of that album were just absolutely fascinating. So I would love the opportunity to chat with anyone who was involved in the production of The Wall. So again, if you know anyone or you have details of someone that we can get in touch with who you think would have an interesting perspective on how this album was produced, absolutely get in touch with me. And as soon as I can, I will be in touch and we'll have a chat about that. But for now, let's draw our attention back to Metallica. Let's draw our attention back to one of the best-selling albums of all time, one of the defining albums in heavy metal. My special guest today is Calvin Lever from Night Screamer. And before we get to my chat with Calvin, let's just have a look at the facts. Here's the beginning of what we need to know about Metallica. Christened the Black Album by its legions of fans, Metallica is the fifth studio album from American heavy metal band Metallica. The Black Album heralded a marked change in direction for the San Francisco four-piece, who had been lauded throughout the 80s for their emergence in the thrash metal genre. Metallica expressed a desire to move away from the thrash style that they helped pioneer, with the help of producer Bob Rock, adopted a more mainstream hard rock and metal sound. While at first contentious, the relationship between Rock and the band proved fruitful, and the finished album was released on the 12th of August 1991, through Elektra Records. Enter Sandman, the opening track on the album, also served as the first single. Released shortly before its parent album, Enter Sandman reached number 16 on the Billboard Hot 100 and number 5 on the UK singles charts. The success of the single drove the phenomenal sales of the Black Album and served Enter Sandman to become one of the most iconic songs of the metal genre. Four additional singles followed, with The Unforgiven, Nothing Else Matters, Wherever I May Roam, and Sad But True, all sealing the fate of the album and indeed the band's change in musical direction. Off the back of the huge success of Enter Sandman, the Black Album became Metallica's first album to reach the summit of the Billboard 200 in the United States. Metallica also reached the top of the charts in the United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, and many more countries. With worldwide sales of over 31 million, the Black Album was certified double platinum in the UK and 16 times platinum in the US, contributing to it becoming one of the best-selling albums in music history. While some of the band's longtime fans struggled with Metallica's transition away from thrash metal, the Black Album is regarded as a milestone in the history of heavy metal and one of the greatest albums in the genre. Q magazine included Metallica in its 2000 list of the best metal albums of all time. Rolling Stone ranked it 25th on their list of the 100 greatest metal albums of all time in 2013. And of course, the Black Album ranks on Rolling Stone's 500 greatest albums of all time, placing 255th in 2003. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about the Black Album, Metallica. And I have here with me my special guest who chose the album to chat about today on My Classic Album. This is Calvin Lever. How's it going?
Hello. Good evening. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. And I'm particularly because you've chosen one of my favourite albums of all time. Before we get too deep into it, why have you chosen the Black Album to talk about on My Classic Album today?
Well, I guess it was, for me, it was the gateway into metal and hard rock. It was the first heavy metal album I bought, and to this day it's still probably my favorite, and I think it sounds as good today as it ever has done, and it's on constant rotation really on my iPod. It's the one album that if I ever can't think of anything to listen to, I listen to that and I never get bored of it.
So you were saying it was the album that introduced you to heavy metal. Coincidentally, I'd say it was probably the same for me as well. What are your memories of hearing that album for the first time? What was that moment like for you?
I just thought it was just sounded awesome. And I just remember sort of playing it in my car really loud and just driving along home from work. It was a sunny day. And it was just it's awesome driving music, I suppose. And just the production of it, I suppose. I just loved the sound. I loved the guitar sounds. Just the riffs are amazing. And I guess James Hetfield being one of my main guitar influences, all my rhythm playing is really kind of inspired by his playing.
So Metallica's self-titled fifth album, and just for anyone who is listening that maybe isn't hugely versed in Metallica, the album's called Metallica. It also gets called the Black Album. We may jump between the two as we go on, but you know, we're talking about the same album, of course. It's regarded by many as a watershed moment, not only in the career of Metallica, but within the history of heavy metal. So for those who may not be hugely versed in Metallica, as I said, we may have a few listening, what makes the Black Album such a standout and a landmark record?
For me, it's where it was a game changer in the genre in terms of sound quality and production. And I think it really changed everything in metal, and it became the sort of benchmark album, I think, for how things should sound.
Yeah, so I mean, indeed, through the 1980s, Metallica were one of the defining elements of the thrash metal scene, along with bands like Megadeth, Slayer, and Anthrax. Metallica, they'd already recorded heavily lauded albums, including their debut Kill 'Em All, Ride the Lightning, and of course the critically acclaimed Master of Puppets. Now, I'd said at the start, the Black Album was my introduction to Metallica and metal. If I was choosing a favourite Metallica album, I would really struggle between this one and Master of Puppets. And I'm sure you'd agree with me that they're very, despite the fact that they're by Metallica, they're very different albums.
Yeah, so I mean, I know a lot of people do always go refer to Master of Puppets being their favourite and the best. And I know some people actually don't like the Black Album and feel kind of betrayed by the band's direction when that album was released. But I don't feel that at all. It's my favourite. Maybe if Master of Puppets had the sort of production quality that this had, maybe it would be a different story. But I just found the sort of grown-up direction that the band was taking, sort of growing old gracefully, in a way, I suppose, just kind of exploring this new direction and concise songs, I suppose. You can throw riffs at songs all day long, but in order to sort of strip it back and get everything perfect, it is actually harder, in my view.
Do you think there's an emotional connection for you personally as well? Obviously, this was the first Metallica album you discovered, so there is always going to be a degree of, like, you know, I think about albums that I discovered first. There's always kind of that emotional connection too, isn't there?
Yeah, of course. And it was one of the first gigs I ever went to as well, the big day out at Milton Keynes Bowl in 1998. So that would have been sort of Garage Inc days, but that was actually the first gig I ever went to. And so sort of seeing Metallica live for the first time, and still probably one of the best shows I've seen even to this day. So yeah, there is definitely a sort of emotional attachment for sure.
So in the story of the Black Album really begins upon the conclusion of Metallica's previous album, And Justice for All. So just to catch people up, released in August 1988, And Justice for All, while a great album in its own right, It wasn't viewed as the home run that Master of Puppets was a couple of years earlier. What are your thoughts on Injustice for All, and why do you think it struggled compared to what came before?
I think, going back to maybe something I said earlier, where you sort of, you can throw riffs at songs all day long, and they can go in all sorts of different directions, and that's great. But maybe it was getting a bit too much on Injustice for All, and you know, it's got some great parts. And it's got some great songs, but all the songs are pretty long, and, you know, they go on for a bit. I think it may be sort of maybe a little bit self-indulgent, maybe. I think it's a great album. Don't get me wrong. I think it's awesome. And, it's a shame that it didn't have, again, going back to sort of the quality of production that some of the others had. Obviously, the big one is, we all know that the bass guitar is obviously very quiet in the album.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I still love it. It's still awesome. But I felt like it was probably a little bit too self-indulgent, and it needed, like with the Black Album, with Bob Rock on board, sort of just refocusing everyone.
And I think it's interesting you picked up on the bass, because that does seem to be one of the huge criticisms of the album, to the point, you know, this decision to bury Jason Newsted's bass really, really deep in the mix, to the point where it's pretty much not there, and the drums and guitars really dominate proceedings, to the point there's even bootlegs out, and Justice for Jason, where, like, someone's had to play around with it all.
I have listened to it. I enjoyed it. It was good. It was interesting to listen to. And yeah, I kind of did sort of gain a bit more of an appreciation for some of the songs, actually, when you sort of just hear the bass. So yeah, I'm glad it happened.
I mean, the significance of all of this is that it shows that maybe for the first time that there were elements of Metallica that just weren't clicking, and there's all sorts of reasons for that. The significance of it is that because they were unhappy with this finished product, that they made a concerted effort to go in the complete opposite direction for what would be their next album. Mm. So James Hetfield told Uncut magazine in 2007, "To me, the Injustice for All album sounds horrible, awful, can't fucking stand it. That was our fancy stage, showing off too much. We knew we had to move on, and the Black album was the opposite. So when me and Lars got back together after a short break, I said, we got to really try and write some shorter, to-the-point songs."
Yeah.
And that's exactly what you just said. You've hit the nail on the head. Obviously, Metallica felt very similar to the way you feel about that album as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I just... Well, it's good that they were able to sort of take a step back and look at themselves and make that decision. And yeah, obviously, bringing out the Black album with the new change, with the new direction, I mean, it's just... And then just elevated them into the stratosphere.
Absolutely. I mean, we've talked a little bit about Bob Rock already, and that's a crucial part to all of this, that Metallica decided to recruit Bob Rock to work with them on the follow-up to Injustice for All. So at this point, Bob was most renowned for producing Motley Crue's 1989 album, Dr. Feelgood. And it was actually his work on that album that made Metallica want Bob to mix their new record. However, Bob had seen them several times and said that he would rather produce the album than mix it. Have you listened to Dr. Feelgood, or indeed any Bob Rock produced albums that aren't Metallica? And is there a kind of, does he have a production style that makes it like immediately obvious, like, oh, this is a Bob Rock album?
Oh, I'm very familiar with Dr. Feelgood, and yeah, there is definitely a style there. I mean, another great sounding album. Bob Rock, I think at the time, he was doing the best work for me in metal and music production. I really loved the way his approach to music and, you know, how he gets the sound to have so much clarity, but so much size. I mean, it's massive. I remember one of the aims for the Black album is to make everything as big as possible, like the drums as big as possible, the bass as big as possible, and just being able to sort of set that as a goal and then, you know, just work towards it and tweaking bits here and there just to get the biggest sound. And then, yeah, and I know some of his production techniques were quite interesting. I've known that there was one story where they weren't quite getting the brightness of the drums. So I think they all went out and bought some like bits of plywood or whatever and then sort of shined it down and waxed it to get it all shiny. And they put it all around the studio in order to kind of get the sounds, you know, bouncing around the room and get a really lively sound. So interesting little things like that.
Now, Lars Ulrich said in the Classic Albums documentary about the Black Album, I don't know if you've seen that before, said that Bob was brutally honest with the band and said that they felt that they hadn't yet captured what Metallica did in a live setting on a studio album.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, a lot of these albums in the 80s, you know, are even now regarded as, like, phenomenal metal albums. But would you agree with him? Or do you think that's perhaps hard to say that we didn't have the opportunity to see Metallica in the 80s? Perhaps that's a difficult call for us to make.
Yeah, I mean, I can only go from really videos such as the Live Shit Binge and Purge live DVD, and obviously there's a live concert in there from the Justice for All tour. And yeah, I think listening to that, there is a difference in like intensity. I don't know, maybe I think he was right, and I think Bob did capture more of Metallica's live sound on the Black Album than had been captured previously. And I think one of the techniques with that was he got the band playing together in the room and recording everyone playing live at the same time. So rather than, okay, we're just going to record the drums now, and then we're going to record the bass over the top of it afterwards, and then the guitars go on afterwards. I mean, that's an absolutely fine way of doing it, but it does, having sort of recorded myself both ways, it does give a slightly different sound. Like if you get everyone playing live at the same time, it just has a bit more dynamism to it.
Hmm. I think it's interesting because, you know, I'm immediately like thinking to like Hysteria by Def Leppard, where it was even like the notes, like that you'd have them playing like individual notes and kind of piecing it all together. And I mean, the album that came out of that's phenomenal, but it's a very different way of working than how we're saying this more collaborative studio effort that's kind of happened with the Black Album.
Yeah, it does give a different feel to it. And I think it's probably a bit more of a rock and roll feel, I think, getting everyone playing live in a room together and recording everything. It's just like we were talking about, if you're trying to capture the live sound more accurately, then yeah, you need to be playing all together at the same time.
So Bob's presence in the studio made for a very different environment than Metallica were used to, and that is one of the reasons that we've been discussing. The production of this album is infamous for the tension between producer and band.
That happens. That really does happen. And it's not an isolated incident. That happens. It's creative tensions and differences and people really passionate and care about what they're producing and have strong opinions and then can't always, some people are not always on the same page. I think it's actually probably healthy in some respects. You do sometimes question things and say, okay, maybe that's not the right way to go. Although that can be a harder, more difficult experience to go through, I think probably at the end of it, you will have a better product. Mm-hmm. I think.
I mean, Kirk Hammett told Loudwire in 2003, he said, the first thing that he told me was that he felt we had never made a record that was up to his standards. That was a bit of a battle cry. We had never been challenged before, and nobody ever really said, well, you can also do it this way, and you can also try it in a different key, or why don't you try this kind of drum fill? We were like, why don't you go fuck yourself and stop telling us what to do? Just get us that bass sound like you got from the Motley Crue album. So I guess they had an idea of what Bob Rock was going to bring to the project, but Bob was like, I'm coming in here full force.
Yeah.
I'm going to create the best possible album for you guys that I can.
I know after the album, I know Lars Ulrich said he never wanted to see him again. And then after that all cooled down, there was Bob Rock went on to produce the next few albums. And I remember Lars did say he couldn't really think of any of working with anyone else after that.
So along with this tension in the studio, three of the four members of Metallica were also having personal problems outside of the studio. So Kirk told Playboy, Lars, Jason and I were going through divorces. I was an emotional wreck. I was trying to take those feelings of guilt and failure and channel them into the music to get something positive out of it. Jason and Lars were too. And I think that has a lot to do with why the Black Album sounds the way it does. So there's interest in that. Obviously, there's the tension between Bob and the band in the studio. There's so much tension going on outside of the studio. And we'll talk a little bit later on about stuff that James was going through. That has to have an effect in the way that album sounds.
Absolutely. I think you can't help things in your outside world. Can't help but filter in to, if you're a creative person and you're creating music, it will just filter in. And so it's the divorce album.
Yeah, and I think it's funny, I think about albums that we've done recently on My Classic Album. So we've recently done Synchronicity by The Police, Damn the Torpedoes by Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. And the thing that all three of these albums have in common is that there was a lot of tension going on while the albums were being recorded for one reason or another. Different issues, but that has to inform music. Just like, I always use the example of Rumours by Fleetwood Mac, that all the craziness that was going on in that band at the time had to inform the songs that were written. And it's just fascinating how that kind of comes across in music.
I mean, that the Rumours one is funny. It's quite dark when you actually get underneath the skin of it and you actually read the lyrics and the like all the different songs are sort of digs at other members in the band, which is quite funny. But it happens.
So I mean, what makes the Black Album stand out from Metallica's first four albums, as we've been touching on, is this change in musical direction. So songs were much slower than the thrash style that the band had helped define in the 80s, as well as being shorter. We talked about kind of And Justice for All possibly being a bit too long, but without sacrificing any heaviness. And in fact, in places, the Black Album is arguably heavier than anything that's come before from the band.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, Jason told Guitar World in 2008, radio airplay wasn't the whole idea behind our writing shorter songs. It seemed to us that we'd pretty much done the longer song format to death. We have one song that has just two riffs in it, which is pretty amazing. It only takes 2 minutes to get the point across. And that is a huge, if you think of songs like Master of Puppets and One and the ones that were coming beforehand, that's a very different tact on how a band are going to record a song from what they were doing even 5 years earlier.
I think, again, I've sort of mentioned it before, but in my opinion, it's actually harder to get a great song from fewer components. It's about sort of stripping it back and what's the essential parts of the song. Do we need to add this epic interlude in the middle? Is it serving the song? Is it doing anything? And just sort of, not getting too carried away.
So inevitably, and we've been talking about this a little bit, inevitably when a band experiments with changing their sound, there's always detractors who accuse them of selling out. And I mean, to be fair, you could argue that Metallica have had this issue since Ride the Lightning, that there were people who just felt that they were moves and decisions they were making that meant that they were selling out. So while the Black Album is their best-selling, and for many their creative and commercial peak, there are others who believe that this is the moment that Metallica sold out. I've got a quote from Mick Thompson from Slipknot, who in 1991, when the album came out, he fell in to this latter camp. He said, "I understand now that I'm in a band that you have to stop repeating yourself or you'll be bored, but I loved those first four albums so much and I was horrified when I heard the Black Album. I felt insulted and didn't listen to them for years, but that's over now. Are there similarities to how Slipknot have changed? I don't think so. And besides, I certainly never cut my fucking hair."
Yeah.
I mean, I guess the question is, and I have a feeling we're going to agree on this, you know, is it harsh criticism to suggest that Metallica sold out? It's this huge moment in their career. And obviously they went on to become one of the biggest bands in the world.
Mm.
Is it harsh to say that they sold out at that point?
I think so. I wouldn't say it's selling out. Okay, it may be a bit more commercial, but it's still heavy metal. Sold out because it's great.
Yeah. I mean, I can't remember who the quote is, but it's like, it's no one from Metallica, but that idea of it's like, oh, it's a have sold out. I've sold out every arena across the world. You know, I'm sure that Lars and the rest of the guys don't particularly lose much sleep.
No.
The thought that they've sold out, you know, because they've had this huge career off the back of it.
Yeah. No, I don't think they're going to be crying too hard about any accusations of selling out, not when they're driving along in supercars.
So the album was, of course, as we've said, this huge breakthrough for Metallica, and it solidified them as one of the biggest bands in the world. So much of what happened next for them can be attributed to the success of this album. Before we go track by track, which we're about to, can you just try and give us a flavour of just how huge this album and consequently Metallica were in the early 90s when the Black Album was released?
Well, I don't know. It's got to be there. They must have been one of the biggest bands in the world at the time. What was the tour? It was an ridiculous amount of dates that just never ended. In order to be able to maintain that touring capacity and mega stadiums and venue and arenas, you know, huge places, thousands of people. And obviously that's the Moscow gig, which is quite famous. I think it was the first free Western music concert after the Soviet era. But no one really knows how many people were there. There's kind of a couple of outrageous claims. I think the most outrageous one I've heard is 1,600,000 people, at one gig. I think that's probably a little bit over the top. I mean, I can't even imagine how many people that must look. How do you even organize that? But I think probably more realistic figures is like 250,000, something like that, which of course is a phenomenal amount of people.
And I guess when you think about kind of the backdrop of what was happening at the time, like grunge was about to like explode. I think Guns N' Roses were probably the biggest band in the world at that point, but obviously they just released the Use Your Illusion albums. Obviously they toured with Metallica. And I think what's interesting is if you think about all the bands that were big at the time, a lot of them have kind of maybe dropped in stature or faded away, whereas Metallica are still as big, if not bigger, than they were at that point now.
Yeah, well, I'm actually going to see them in Ireland next weekend at the Slane Castle gig. So, yeah, we'll see how many people turn up there.
So we'll head track by track.
Yeah, let's go for it.
So we'll start with Enter Sandman. Inarguably, the most well-known Metallica song, not only on the album, but their entire career. And it was guitarist Kirk Hammett who came up with the two-bar riff before Lars suggested repeating that first bar three times, and this iconic riff was born. What are your thoughts on Enter Sandman, and how does it fare as an introduction to this album?
I think it's, yeah, I like it. I mean, obviously, it's the one you've heard the most, and I probably wouldn't put it on as a choice, really. I probably, if it comes on, great, it's an awesome song. But if I was to put it on, like, a best of sort of thing, I may end up skipping that. Yeah, great song. I've got a very vivid memory again of sort of just driving back from work on a sunny afternoon, with the windows down and absolutely blaring it out and really not giving shit about anything. And it was, just a very vivid memory. And I always kind of had that, relate that song to that kind of moment.
So Lars called Enter Sandman the foundation, the whole guide to the record as they were producing it. So it was the first song to be mixed, which means that when Bob was mixing that, he's not only finding the sound of the song, but you could argue the sound of the entire album. And it actually took him 10 days to mix Enter Sandman.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I guess so. Yeah, once you've got that blueprint be easier for the rest to fall in place after that. But yeah, interesting. I didn't know that was the first one, or the guinea pig song, if you like, for to get the sound.
So the heaviness and the thickness in this song comes from what James has called a wall of guitars.
Yeah.
So there's actually three rhythm guitar tracks going on in the Sandman.
Yeah. The thickener, I think he refers to as the third one, the thickener.
I mean, would you agree with me? This creates a very different sound to their previous albums, because as much as they were heavy and there was a lot going on, I wouldn't think they particularly sounded as thick, and it instantly, we're talking about a very different sound when you put this album on. It instantly creates a very different vibe to what you've heard in previous Metallica albums.
Yeah, I mean, it has a very thick guitar sound, and I mean, we've been Night Screamer, my band, we've used same sort of techniques. Well, there was four rhythm tracks for each song, just to really pad it out and also blend sounds. I don't know whether I know, so they were using the Mesa Boogie amp a lot on the Black Album, but I don't know whether they may have been mixing that in with like another amp sound. So it's not just about creating layers of the same sound. It's sort of slightly different sounds, and then they kind of blend together. And also just playing three separate tracks, just the little nuances, the little differences, again, make for a thicker sound. You can't just record one guitar track and then duplicate it three times. It doesn't work. You have to play it originally every time in order to kind of get that thicker sound.
So at this stage in their careers, Metallica kept music and lyrics separate until very late on in the process. And indeed, Enter Sandman was one of the last songs to have lyrics. So we'll talk a lot about James Hetfield's songwriting as we go on. For this one, he was concerned that the song sounded too commercial. So initially, Enter Sandman's lyrics were actually about cot death.
So
this seems to me like, and I could be wrong, I might be interpreting wrong, like a really good example of this kind of prickly relationship between Bob and the band, where James has thought, well, this sounds really commercial, you know, this isn't what we want, I'm going to make this song as controversial as I possibly can to kind of to counterbalance this new sound that we're creating.
Yeah, well, I didn't know that was that's what it was about, but yeah, I suppose if you're sounding too commercial, then, yeah, you want to be, you still got to shock people.
I've got a quote from Bob talking to Music Radar in 2011 about the lyrics. He said, at first, based on the music and the riff, the band and their management thought it could be the first single. Then they heard James's lyrics and realised the song was about crib death. That didn't go over so well. I sat down with James and talked to him about his words. I told him, what you have is great, but it can be better. Does it have to be so literal? Not only was I thinking about the single, I just wanted him to make the song great. It was a process. Him learning to say what he wanted, but in a more poetic and open sort of way. He rewrote some lyrics, and it was all there, the first single. And I think as we get deeper into the album, we can hear that poetic side of James Hetfield really coming out. And this seems like quite an integral part of when that began. So, interestingly, the majority of the band, as well as Bob, believe that Holier Than Thou should be the album opener and the lead single.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. When we got to that song, because I know that was going to... That was the plan, and that would be the first song.
Yeah. And I mean, it was actually Lars who fought for Enter Sandman to hold both positions as album opener and lead single.
That's right, yeah.
If we kind of balance the two songs together, how do you think Holier Than Thou would have fared as a lead single and to open the album?
I could definitely hear it as an opener when I found out about that information. And then I listened to the track. I was like, do you know what? I know exactly why they would have wanted that as the first single. You know, it's a punchy opening straight in there. You know, it's a bit thrash. I know they talk about moving on from thrash metal, but Holier Than Thou is quite a thrashy song. The dun, da dun, 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 dun. But yeah, I mean, I think they probably made the right decision, but yeah, I can definitely see how that could have been the opener.
So Enter Sandman has become one of Metallica's most loved songs and was even named amongst Rolling Stone's 500 greatest songs of all time. What is it about the song, you think, that makes it so special to so many people? I guess there's the danger that it's been overplayed, but obviously there's something about it that we all love.
Yeah, it's just a great riff, and it's just, I don't know. I've been in loads of bars, and every time that song comes on, everyone nods their head. It just always grabs people. It doesn't matter where it is or whether you've kind of got bored or not, but it's still... When it comes on in a bar, everyone enjoys it.
So we'll move on to another track with an awesome riff, which is Sad But True.
This is my favourite song ever.
Right.
Full stop. Cool. There is none better. I love this song. Just the heaviness is immense. And it's just that chugging, the dun, 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 dun. There's the rhythm playing is just a testament, really, for me, of how good James Hetfield is as a rhythm player and a riff writer. It has to be played a certain way in order to pull you along, that dun, 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 the kind of chugginess and the heaviness. It just has to be played a certain way, and it's just absolutely nailed in this song.
How important do you think that this song particularly is in influencing what comes after in terms of heavy metal? We've talked about this album being really influential. I've got to think that the riff and the song Sad But True has to be a huge part of that.
Yeah, I think it's set a new precedent, I think, for how heavy a song could be, which is awesome. I mean, in Night Scream, we've got a song called March of the Dead, which is heavily influenced by my love of this song. So yeah, check out that song and hopefully you could hear some similarities or where the inspiration came.
Bob Rock, during the production of the album, he identified it Sad But True. He called it like a cashmere for the 90s. That was kind of the quote that it was always bandied around. It almost sounded very different, and it's a good example of the influence that Bob had on Metallica during these sessions. So he'd said, we were in pre-production, which was uncomfortable because nobody had ever made them go through pre-production in such a way before. And six songs in, Sad But True came along. Suddenly I realised that every song, including this one, was in the key of E. I brought this to the band's attention, and they said, well, isn't E the lowest note? So I told them that on Dr. Feelgood, which I produced and Metallica loved, the band had tuned down to D. Metallica then tuned to D, and that's when the riff really became huge. It was this force that you just couldn't stop no matter what.
Yeah, I do know it is one of the songs that is down-tuned the most, I believe, on that. I thought it was down-tuned to C-sharp, but I think, anyway, that's... Yeah, interesting that, again, sort of how different playing things in different keys does give the song a different feel. And I've heard it played as well. There's a song that can't be played too fast. I've heard Metallica play it live, and in some instances, if you play it too fast, it becomes happy, loses its heaviness. There's something on YouTube somewhere of, it's just played too fast. It becomes almost like a sort of jolly waltz, which is not what we want, really.
We were talking a bit earlier on about kind of creative methods that Bob had in the studio, and there's a really good one for Sad But True, that in this instance, Metallica and Bob created what James called the Tent of Doom. So I don't know if you've heard about this.
I haven't, no. I'm intrigued.
They constructed like a makeshift space out of foam walls and blankets to create this kind of crunching guitar sound on Sad But True. And surely, you know, from your experience working in the studio, that must be a hugely rewarding part of the recording process when you can't quite get the piece of the puzzle together. And maybe you have to think outside the box and come up with something really unique to get like a really cool sound.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's no rules really. That's part of the beauty of sort of recording. You can record anything. And if you can find a place for it in a song, then awesome. I mean, I guess we didn't get massively sort of creative when it came to new sounds on our album, but we got a song called Rise Above, and there's a kind of gang vocal kind of chant through the songs, like Rise Above, and so Gad, our lead singer, in order to sort of capture that sort of crowd sound, if you like, he brought around soft football and just kind of hollowed it out, and he stuck the microphone in the middle of the football, and then we were just sort of he stuck it in the middle of the room. We were just there shouting into this football. But yeah, it worked.
But that's what I mean, kind of really creative stuff like that. And I love it when you hear that from albums, that someone thought outside the box and ended up with a really cool result at the end of it as well.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Yeah.
So like Enter Sandman before it, Sad But True has become a truly iconic moment for Metallica, covered by many, even sampled by Kid Rock for his track American Badass, which was about 10 years later.
Yeah.
So we've talked a lot about the riff. What else is there in Sad But True that just makes it such an awesome song that so many metal bands want to cover?
I think it's another really good example of where James and Lars connect. I know Lars gets criticism for his drumming, but one thing that he did say, and I think it is true, that I don't think any drummer can connect with James Hetfield's rhythm playing like he can. And it's about getting those, you know, those kick drums in the right place that makes it, makes the song as big and as powerful as possible. I do agree that Lars Ulrich is perfect at doing that.
Calvin Lever there chatting with me about his chosen classic album, The Black Album by Metallica, and we'll get back to my chat with Calvin in just a little bit. It's just absolutely awesome that we're finally doing a Metallica album on the podcast. If you're sitting there listening thinking, why on earth are they not doing Master of Puppets? Ride the lightning, kill them all. Just get in touch. I'd love to know your thoughts on Metallica, their career, the album, everything. Get yourself to our social media pages and just let us know exactly how you feel about this band and this album. When it comes to Calvin, you know, he said that Sad But True is his favourite song of all time, and that March of the Dead, which is from their debut album, Dead of Night, is heavily inspired by the sound and perhaps even the ethos of Sad But True. And Calvin and the band have very kindly agreed to let me play March of the Dead here on my classic album, so you can judge for yourself. Absolutely awesome track. As I said, it's from their debut album, Dead of Night. Here are Night Screamer with March of the Dead.
We'll be right back.
enjoying this episode of My Classic Album? Don't forget there are loads of amazing albums covered in our previous episodes as part of Season 1, with guests including Guns N' Roses keyboardist Dizzy Reed.
If I had to pick one like favorite band or I guess a band that was the biggest influence on me, I would go with the Rolling Stones.
Blues guitarist Big Boy Blotter.
It sounded great then and it sounded great now. It just seems to have stood the test of time with me anyway. So yeah, it's a real classic for me.
And Nathan Stevens Griffin of Martha.
It's a great song musically, you're absolutely right. It's a banger. Mm-hmm. It is like absolutely a barnstormer of an album opener right there.
Also, there's our anniversary episodes, such as 40 Years of Rumours with Fleetwood Mac, including an interview with engineer Ken Kelly.
Within about 15 minutes, the band was fighting. I've seen, you know, Crosby, Stills and Nash fight. I've seen Kenny Loggins and Jim Messina fight, but this was a weird. I've never seen couples fight.
And 40 Years of Bat Out of Hell, including an interview with the voice of Paradise by the Dashboard Light, Ellen Foley.
Time is sometimes tricky. Sometimes things seem like very long ago in another life, which it is, but it all, the memories of it and certainly the song itself is always sort of alive in my mind.
All these episodes and more are available at www.myclassicalbum.co.uk and on Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network.
So we'll move on to Holier Than Thou, which we talked about a little earlier.
Yeah.
It always seemed closer to me, and you said this as well, it seems closer to that kind of thrash styling of previous Metallica albums.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on Holier Than Thou? I know that you'd said that it would have been a good album opener. Do you think it can be seen as a bridge of sorts between 80s Metallica and the rest of the album?
Yeah, I think it's a cool song, and it is kind of a nod, I think, to some of the thrashier stuff in the past. And I know why they would have wanted it to be the opener, sort of straight into it, no nonsense. It's quite a punchy opener to that song, and it grabs your attention.
I mean, if we think back to what we were discussing earlier during Enter Sandman, both Bob Rock and Metallica were adamant that at one point in the album's production that this would be the lead single. Now, out of 12 songs on the album, 5 were released as singles. I think there was even a promotional single thrown in there as well. Yet, Holier Than Thou wasn't one of them, which I think perhaps, rather than it being a case of a detriment to the song, I think that's more testament to the strength of the material on this album, that at one point they were like, this is track 1, single 1, and then by the end, it wasn't even a single.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, actually. I don't know. There are other tracks on the album which definitely lend themselves better to singles, I think, definitely. So I can see how that would have happened. And I'm quite surprised it doesn't make its way off too often into their live performances. I've seen Metallica loads of times, and I think I've only ever seen them play it once. And it's not, you know, it's not one of the bread and butter songs that you often hear them play, which is, considering if they loved it so much and wanted it to be the album opener, I'm wondering where that sort of love for it maybe died a little bit.
So Kirk addressed some of the criticism surrounding the heaviness of the Black Album compared to other Metallica albums shortly after the album was released. So he told Rolling Stone in 91, "I've run into fans who think the album's crap. Friends of mine who are really hardcore fans have said, well, the album's not as heavy. You guys aren't as heavy as you used to be. I say, man, you're trying to tell me Sad But True isn't heavy? Holier Than Thou isn't heavy? How do you define heavy?" And I guess that's the point, that, you know, have things been slowed down? Yes, absolutely. But as we've been saying along, I don't think that sacrificed any heaviness at all. If anything, a track like Holier Than Thou or Sad But True, they're as heavy as Metallica get.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know how you could not call that album heavy.
Exactly, yeah. We'll move on to The Unforgiven. So there's a lot of praise for The Unforgiven from many corners. Metal Hammer actually ranked The Unforgiven as the best song on the Black Album.
Interesting.
Would you agree it's the best song on the album? Actually, I guess you would say it was Sad But True.
It is Sad But True, yeah. So, no, but it's a great song. I mean, there's only one track that I don't think is amazing, and we'll get to that later. But, yeah, I mean, all the songs are so strong, and so it's really difficult to really, I mean, all people have their different favourites, really. I think they're all, every song could be someone's favourite.
So vocally, James actually took inspiration from the Chris Isaak track Wicked Game, and he approached Bob asking him, how do I sing like this? So Bob told Chris Jericho on his podcast Talk with Jericho, I said, I'll get you a great vocal sound so you don't have to double your vocals. What you hear in Chris Isaak's voice is the nuances when he sings. He isn't doubled. He's actually performing. You perform. So they set it up so James was comfortable and he was happy with everything. And then when he sang, he got the result that he wanted. You know, he, as Bob says, he became a great singer. And that's one aspect of this track, that it's the moment, if you, not that we do that these days, but if you were to listen to Metallica chronologically from Kill 'Em All right through to this point, it's the moment when we hear James sing in a very different way from what we've heard before.
Yeah, I think he really pushed himself on this album and became into a lot of another level, really, of singer, not just about the growling and the that sort of baritone rasp. It was, you know, he can sing. He can sing really well. And I mean, the vocals on Kill 'Em All aren't, my view, not amazingly strong, but just to sort of see how far he'd sort of come in those last couple of albums was, it's really came into a world of his own, really.
I mean, I also absolutely love Kirk's solo on this one. And interestingly, when I've looked into it, he actually found it really difficult, in his eyes, to get it right. He said of the final solo, it's pretty much the type of guitar solo I've been trying to do for the past 5 or 6 years. I'm really proud of that. So I know we were talking about how the band all played together. I think before this, Kirk would come in towards the end of the sessions and he would lay them down separately. So that was a big change for him. Does the solo feel different to you? Again, if we were to listen from Kill 'Em all the way to this point, does it feel like a different Kirk Hammett guitar solo at this point?
Yeah, I think with all the guitar solos, again, they're all just a bit more grown up and a bit more thought about. And it's almost, you know, a guitar solo can almost be a mini song within a song, if you like. I think these solos just all the right notes were chosen. Like I said, again, I think what I mentioned before, with you don't have to throw millions of notes at it or do something unbelievably technical. It just needs to be melodic and, you know, just serve the song.
So this is the first of three songs in Metallica's career that share the name The Unforgiven. So it has two sequels of sorts. The Unforgiven 2 appears on 1997's Reload, and The Unforgiven 3 appears on Death Magnetic. What are your thoughts on 2 and 3? You know, do they live up to this one? And is there anything for you that connects the three songs, obviously, other than the obvious?
I hated the second one for ages, for years. I didn't understand it. I thought, I didn't get the song. I didn't like it. But over time, I grew to quite like it. And I still like it. And then the third one, I quite like. To me, they probably could have been called something else and didn't really have, they don't really sound like sequels to the first and the original one. For me, they don't. So they could be just more standalone songs. I don't really hear much of a thread through all of them that binds them together.
So we'll move on to Wherever I May Roam. So we were talking earlier about how awesome the riff to Sad But True is. Here's another one of my favourite riffs on the album. Bob says of this one, realistically, the guys in Metallica can shit out riffs all day and half of them will be incredible. When you hang out with them, though, you start to hear the difference between a great riff and a Smoke on the Water type riff. Metallica had several on this album, and I'd say this one's pretty high up there. I like the phrase that he used there. Is the riff from Wherever I May Roam, is it a Smoke on the Water type riff by Metallica standards?
Yeah, it's a pretty iconic riff, actually. And the intro as well, sort of that big crash in the beginning of the song, it's quite an iconic opener for them, I think. And yeah, it's a classic riff. It's awesome. Again, just not overplaying things and pairing it back to its purity. And that's all you need to do.
And I think what really makes this song stand out too is the use of that sitar, which at that stage in their career is a total sidestep from what they've done before. Now, Bob, actually, you know, if you think about what we've spoken about, you might have thought that was Bob's idea. He credits that idea to the band rather than himself. We've heard so much about Metallica battling against this change that Bob was bringing in, and yet here's a moment where perhaps they were fully embracing that change, where they were like, well, look, this is working. Let's just throw everything at the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah, so it's quite a distinctive sound, isn't it? It gives that song its kind of voice, I think. Gives it like its own identity, I think, with the sitar. Just, yeah, I can't really think of any other song that Metallica do that use it, but yeah, you know, that sound, it really stands out from from the rest.
So lyrically, Wherever I May Roam talks about life on the road, which is somewhat ironic when you consider, as we were talking about, Metallica would embark on this ridiculous world tour in support of the Black Album. 14 months I've got here, it was possibly even longer than that, named the Wherever We May Roam tour. And subsequent Metallica tours have always been huge in length and scope. I mean, the one they're on at the minute is, that's been on for a couple of years now, possibly at least.
Mm.
You'd said you'd seen Metallica many, many times.
I have, yes.
How does their live show, obviously it was 1998 you said was the first time.
Yeah.
How has that live show evolved over the past, well, the past 20 years?
Well, so the first, that 1998 one was the only time I saw them with Jason. I love Jason, I used to do some bass guitar myself, and he's one of my bass guitar heroes. And from what I can remember, I mean, we're going back a bit now, but it did have a different feel, that show, to the ones, to the subsequent ones with Rob. And Rob's a great bass player as well. But that particular, that first one, I remember it being, having a slightly different sort of sound to it. Not worse or better, just slightly different. And then after that, with introduction of Rob having a bit of sort of more low end in his bass sound, more, a cleaner bass sound as well. Jason used to play quite a reasonably distorted, I think, or a bit more distorted bass guitar. And with Rob's also finger style. But yeah, I mean, all through the sort of from the 2000s and up until now, it's always been, I'd say, pretty consistent. They always sound great, better than what live clips actually make them out to be. I think you need to be there really to experience it.
Absolutely. There is something just about, you know, I mean, I've seen them in Donington, I've seen them at Nebworth. There's just something about that. There's just something in the air at a Metallica show that, and I've been to loads of live shows over the years, but there's just something about Metallica shows that just, it's just not replicated.
Yeah, I think it's the massiveness, the size, and there's a real event. That's one of the reasons why I still go to watch them, is because even though I love the music, it's the one time that they're just such massive events. There's not many bands these days that can fill a stadium, you know, just one band, 80,000 people in a stadium. It's, and I love the size of it. And, you know, it's about just making something that's massive. And yeah, and there aren't many bands that can do that these days.
So we'll move on to Don't Tread on Me. So this was released as a promo single before the main album's release. Don't Tread on Me is an interesting one lyrically, as it could almost be seen, and has been seen by some, as a reaction to a lot of the anti-American tone of Injustice for All. Some fans misinterpreted the lyrics to mean that the band were now pro-war, when past songs by Metallica might possibly indicate the opposite. What are your thoughts on Don't Tread on Me? And do you think it sticks out like a sore thumb compared to some of their, what, you know, anti-war, for lack of a better term, of their earlier albums?
I'm not sure about all the anti-war stuff. It's actually the one song that I would probably skip. I still like it, but it's my least favorite one on the album.
Hmm.
So the title of the song, it does come from some military context. I can't remember exactly, but I know it also has something to do with the snake that's on the front cover. So the snake comes from a seal or something from the, which has some military background and connotation. And I know underneath the snake, it has Don't Tread on Me. And I know that's where that comes from.
I mean, I've got a quote with James with Rolling Stone, where he was trying to explain kind of his interpretation of the song. He said, "This is the other side of that. America is a fucking good place. I definitely think that. And that feeling came out from touring a lot. You find out what you like about certain places, and you find out why you live in America, even with all the bad fucked up shit. It's still the most happening place to hang out." And I guess that's it, that they wouldn't live in America if they didn't love the place, that, you know, they could move, you know. So I guess there's something that, you know, you were saying you weren't sure about kind of anti-war and pro-war. I would agree with you there. I just think that, you know, they're just songs that they've written. And I think that sometimes people can look a bit too deep into that kind of thing.
Yeah, people read into things a bit too much, I think. And sometimes you're just looking for inspiration to write some cool lyrics and write a cool song. But I'm not sure about the anti-war thing.
So the song was never actually performed live until Metallica celebrated 20 years of the Black Album, when they toured it in 2012 and played the European Black Album tour, which they actually played the album backwards.
Oh, I was there. And is that the one, did you say you were at Nebworth?
I was at Nebworth, but I don't know if that was that one.
Right.
But I was at Nebworth. It was the first Sonosphere, and it was them in Linkin Park were headlining.
Okay. Because that was, I was there at the Black Album 20th anniversary, and that was also at Nebworth. That was a Sonosphere gig. Right, yeah. Well, I didn't know they'd never played it live before, so that's a good one for me to tick off.
Yeah, yeah. And I wonder if perhaps some of the controversy surrounding the lyrics meant that the band thought, you know, obviously they've got this album full of hits. You know, even you'd said yourself that that's the one you'd skip. Perhaps there wasn't a particularly strong desire to play it until the point where you're celebrating the album.
Yeah, I don't know what it is about that song. It just doesn't quite connect with me as well with the other tracks. Just maybe that sort of intro sounds a bit superhero-ish, but yeah, for me, it's the weakest track.
So we'll move on to Through the Never. So it always seems on albums like these, with like all these huge anthems, that certain album tracks seem destined to be deemed like filler, you know, and Through the Never is one of those. So Metal Hammer suggests that Through the Never is a ridiculously fine song by anyone else's standards. On an album of such a towering quality, it's rather harshly relegated here to an also-ran status. Would you agree with that? Do you think that perhaps it would fared better on another album?
It's one of my favourites on this album, so I think it's a classic. I think if it was on another album, it could well have been the best song on that album. It fits in for me, and I don't think it gets played enough.
I mean, Metal Hammer also speculated that it would fit really well on Injustice for All. I guess, like Holier Than Thou, there is something about it that alludes to that Metallica sound that's come before. It does feel a bit thrashier than some of the other songs on the album.
Yeah, it's fast. It's no nonsense. It's, yeah, a little nod to, I think, you know, the Metallica's speed metal roots.
So Bob Rock told Music Radar, it took me a while to realise what was good in Through the Never, but once I did, I realised that it was quite good. And what's good is that there's a bit of fiery punk rock vibe to it, a new shade, a new colour. That was exciting. And I think that's a really good point that I think a lot of people sleep on, you know, they're called Metallica. The word metal is in the name. I think people who don't listen to them or don't want to give them a chance, they sleep on that there's a lot more going on in their sound than just metal. There are punk influences. There's even classic rock influences going on in there to create the Metallica sound that we love.
Actually, that's quite an interesting one that you, Metallica obviously being a metal band, but one thing that, about this album is that, you know, it's a classic hard rock album. It's not just a classic metal album. It goes wider than that. I don't think you could say that about really much of the other albums, but it kind of moves outside of that. Just this is a metal album, and you know, it's got a lot of influence from classic rock riffs, and yeah, it can sit with like in metal, and it can sit in classic rock as well.
We'll move on to Nothing Else Matters. So this is one of my favourite Metallica songs, and surely one of their most well-known and loved. Nothing Else Matters was initially a song that James wrote for himself. So he told Jeff Woods in 2006, "That was a song that was not meant to be played for other people. It was for me. I think that's important. To write music that makes you feel good. I've got quite a few songs that are like that. Nothing Else Matters was heard by the band. They thought it was amazing. I thought, you're crazy. That's just this sappy ballady thing that makes me feel okay." So does the song stand out for you in that regard? Obviously, it's very different to what they've done before, but does it kind of stand out in the idea that perhaps, obviously, it's a Metallica song that wasn't even written for Metallica?
I think it does. I think it definitely stands out as being more personal. I think that definitely comes across. And it's worth noting that like the guitar solo is one of the few guitar solos played by James Hetfield as well. So, but yeah, I think it does stick out as something more personal.
So, and I think it must have been, I mean, the whole album is somewhat of a gamble for them, but this song particularly, as we touched on earlier on, that, you know, when they released Fade to Black on Ride the Lightning, people were saying, you've sold out, and that we're at album two. So, you know, we get to this point, and this is a deeply personal song, could be classed by some as a ballad. You know, James didn't even have the band in mind when he wrote it. It's a huge gamble, especially when you think that, you know, there's orchestral stuff going on. You know, it's very, very different, a huge gamble for them at this point.
Yeah, I think it'd be interesting to see who was really the driving force about getting that onto the album. Like you say, James Hetfield felt it was very deeply personal, and it was for him. It wasn't Metallica's song. So I wonder who had the kind of vision, whether it was Bob Rock or the other guys in the band, that to sort of hear it and say, all right, that could fit. Yeah, and it was an interesting sort of to have the orchestra on it as well from Michael Kamen. And I know he was just as surprised as probably everyone was that that song comes was a Metallica song.
So it's even to the point where, you know, James was actually worried that people would be physically ill upon hearing the song. They did a nice big listening party in Madison Square Garden, and he thought, when this song comes on, people are going to be physically sick. And yet here we are, where it's one of the most celebrated songs on the album. What is it, do you think, that helps it avoid the sort of pitfalls that James was worrying about, it being sappy and ballady? What is it about it that helps it kind of avoid those pitfalls?
I just think it's genuine. It comes from a very personal place, and because it had no intention really of ever being a Metallica song or even being on the album. There's nothing fake in that song. It's, and I think everyone can kind of relate to it, and I think that comes through.
So we did Appetite for Destruction on the podcast not too long ago, and when we talked about Sweet Child of Mine, we were talking about the same kind of things that, you know, what makes that song work is kind of the genuineness and the honesty of it, and both these songs in the wrong hands. And I imagine there are some people that do think these songs are soppy or wet or whatever words you want to find, but I think the majority of us would believe that neither of those songs come across that way. And it's that kind of integrity almost that helps both songs over the top, like you were saying.
Yeah, it's just honest and genuine. And you, if things are fake, then you kind of pick up on it, and it just, there's just something not quite right about it. I mean, these sorts of songs, they can't really be forced. It has to come from, you know, an organic place, and it does.
So we've talked a little bit about the orchestral arrangement on the song. It was composed by Michael Kamen, and it was actually Michael's work on Nothing Else Matters and the Elevator version of the song that indirectly led to the S&M album, where Metallica performed many of their biggest songs with the backing of the San Francisco Symphony, conducted by Michael Kamen. Do you think that the work of Metallica lends itself to that kind of orchestral intervention? I mean, I love that album personally. It's another one that kind of around the time I was getting into Metallica, like I bought the Black Album and my best friend had S&M. And so I kind of discovered them around the same time. So I almost intrinsically linked the two together, even though, you know, they were recorded a few years apart.
Yeah, I think a lot of metal lends itself towards orchestral music. They're very similar, actually. I've kind of question this myself. Well, how does it work? Why does it work? But classical music is very dramatic, and it's very powerful, and so is metal. And even though the sounds are different, some of the way that the music is composed and put together is actually quite similar, and it just seems to fit together somehow. And obviously that was quite a pioneering thing to do back in when that was released. But I mean, now after that, there's all sorts of like symphonic metal bands that, you know, go full in with the orchestral arrangements and whatnot.
So we'll move on to Of Wolf and Man. So when I discovered Metallica, this was actually one of my favorites on the album. However, it's been subject to criticism over the years due to the lyrical themes of wolves and shape-shifting and all that kind of thing, seen as perhaps too corny or cheesy. Would you agree with that, or do you think that's harsh criticism for the song?
It sounds a bit harsh to me. I mean, I hadn't really read too much into the lyrics, to be honest. It's another one of those ones that's just tends to find its way into their live set quite a lot, and it just works as well as a live track.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like even Bob Rock was at first critical of the lyrics, but he soon came round as he believes that the song has a kind of earthiness to it. That's the word that he used.
Yeah, I don't know. So for me, it feels quite primal. I don't know, this kind of caveman kind of primal feel to it. I don't know what that is or why, but that's sort of my impression, or the kind of the way I feel when I hear it.
I mean, that's really interesting, actually, because I've got a quote from Bob saying that we talked about making the song go through a transformation, kind of reflecting the lyrics. It took a while. I'm not sure if we got there fully, but we got there most of the way. And I guess that's what you're saying. There's this kind of primalness to it. Obviously, we're talking about wolves and all that kind of thing. That would fit in really well, that perhaps that's what you're picking up on, what they tried to do with the song.
Yeah, maybe. there's some sort of subliminal stuff going on there that maybe I didn't realise before. So that's quite interesting. I have to listen to that again after this with new ears.
So we'll move on to The God That Failed. So this is one of the most personal songs on the album. The God That Failed explores James's feelings around the death of his mother, who refused treatment for cancer, believing that God would heal her. So Billboard single out the song, saying Hetfield's lyrics about relying too much on religion are as poignant today as they were when they were recorded. Would you agree that the lyrics are particularly powerful on this one? I know we've talked about kind of the honesty in a song like Nothing Else Matters. This is a very different kind of personal.
Yeah, another one of my favourites actually on this album. It's just quite dark, I think. So for me, I always sit The God That Failed and the song after My Friend of Misery. They're quite close. They both have a more kind of personal and dark theme. Yeah, it sort of takes you to a slightly different place where, like a lot of the other tracks, they're just, you know, in your face, hard rock and metal. And then over these sort of two tracks, it becomes a little sort of a bit darker and takes you to another place. It's not just all about, you know, the riff.
I mean, it's a song that I often use for detractors of metal who think it's all like noise and lacks any kind of nuance and intelligence. Because it's a very complex song lyrically. And I think, again, we've talked a lot about James Hetfield's songwriting. You know, this is a really strong example of just what a phenomenal, perhaps even one underrated songwriter James Hetfield is.
Yeah, I think so. I think he's phenomenal, like one of my personal heroes. And I think he is sort of unsung as his songwriting abilities. I mean, obviously gets lauded for his voice and guitar playing, but yeah, I think the sort of arrangements, again, this song and My Friend of Misery, they're more complex than what you would actually be led to believe.
So another element of this song that I love is Jason Newsted on bass. Jason's role in the history of Metallica is in some ways an unfortunate one. And I think outside of the furor surrounding And Justice for All, you'd said what a great bass player you think he is, kind of one of your inspirations playing that particular instrument. I think he's a very underrated bass player. And we're going to talk a lot more about Jason on our next track as well. Being that we actually get to hear him on this album, how do you rate his performance on the Black Album?
Well, it's just second to none, really. I think the bass sound is massive. I think they really achieved what they were looking for with the goal of trying to make all the instruments sound as big as possible. And this is the bass in particular. Is just a really big bass sound. It's just great to be able to hear him in isolation as well on some of the tracks. And it's not all just about the guitar riff. You know, some of the bass could be just as a powerful intro as well, as we know with this particular song.
So we'll move on to My Friend in Misery. Talking about Jason, he is a big part of this next song. As we approach the end of the album, we're encountering songs that are perhaps deeper cuts than like Enter Sandman's and Sad But True's. Those involved in the production called this one Jason's song, which when we consider what we've just been saying about his role in the band at that point, this song in some ways is a huge step from him finally stepping out of the shadow of Cliff Burton, who obviously had played on the first three Metallica albums.
Yeah, well, I think he obviously gets his sort of moment halfway through the song where everything sort of quietens down. Probably one of the iconic, there's two iconic bass riffs, I suppose, the one at the beginning of the song, and then again the one midway through in the bridge with the quieter guitar, which I know also in the live environment they drag out and make more of a feature to like celebrate that part of the song, which is very concise, which is again what we've gone to talk about before. Just making everything just the right length, just as long as it needs to be. Yeah, in the live environment, dragging it out and then adding more dimensions to it. And it becomes something else. And it's a really dynamic part because you can just layer other stuff over it in a live environment.
So Jason talked about the song to Billboard in 2016. And he said that was the moment where those guys kind of bowed and said, here you go, man, put your song on there. Being the guy who came up with that, as opposed to being part of the team, I got to be myself for a minute there, which was a real accomplishment. And I think when you think about, and I think even Metallica have since admitted in more recent years that their treatment of Jason was at times not the best. This must have been a huge moment for him in the band that he, you know, they respected what he was doing and they were letting him have that opportunity to lay that down. When you think about how he must have felt when he finally heard Injustice for All for the first time, fast forward to this point.
Yeah, I think he's finally he got the validation that he needed, and rightly so. I really miss him in Metallica, actually. I like Rob. He's an awesome player, but I don't know. There was something about that band that, I don't know, it was just something special.
So Bob Rock has said that the song is more about a mood and an atmosphere than the rest of the songs on the album. Do you get that vibe? That obviously, we've talked that lyrically it's very dark, but almost, it almost explores that concept of misery musically as well as lyrically.
It's very moody, yeah. It just conjures up images of, I don't know, dark forests or something. Yeah, it's nice to just have that song within the context of all the other big hitters on that album, just to, as a kind of respite, I suppose, from the intensity of the metal riffs, I suppose. And then, it's just a great way to get near the end of the album, just sort of have a breather, but also it's a bit more of a reflective song.
And we are at the last track of the album, The Struggle Within.
And we're there.
Yeah,
wow.
We're there. So this was the last song written and recorded during the Black Album sessions. And when we consider that personal issues surround all the band members during these sessions, James has said in the past that the song sums up a lot of the anger that he was feeling at the time. He said, "I'm no psychiatrist, but it's right there." Does The Struggle Within seem like the culmination of all the anger and frustration that they all must have been feeling for a variety of reasons that we've been talking about?
I think that definitely comes across. It's, you know, it's fast, it's energetic. You've had a shit day and you just want to come home and you just want to play something fast and heavy. And that is just captured in that song. I think it just, yeah, it's just angry and it's aggressive and it's venting.
I guess that kind of deep cut status that it's got means it never seems to rank particularly high when people are talking about their favourite songs on the album. Metal Hammer actually ranked it dead last in its ranking of songs from the Black Album, saying, "Metallica albums generally end with a bang, not a whimper, but despite its dramatic intro, The Struggle Within never reaches such heady heights." That Metallica didn't play the song live until their hand was forced by their decision to play the Black Album in full speaks to its place in the album's pecking order. How do you feel about that? Do you think it deserves to be in? I mean, I know you'd said that Don't Tread on Me for you is the one that you'd skip.
It would be the second weakest. When I say weakest, I think it's still a really good song. It's a bit of a weird one. It doesn't have the closure that some of the tracks on previous albums gave the album, like you've already mentioned, Damage Inc. and Dire's Eve and Call of Cthulhu. You know, those are big songs to end on, and it doesn't quite have the punch of those end of those other Metallica albums, but obviously the process was probably, they were probably quite frustrated by this point. So maybe it is the right song for in the right place to describe how they were feeling and what was happening at the end of that album.
I mean, obviously with all that in mind, how does it end the album for you? Like, do you think that there's other tracks that you'd put there instead, or are you satisfied that you think that maybe that is the song that should end the album?
No, I think that is the song that should end it, because as you say, with the aggression and maybe the frustration that was being felt in the band, I think the album should reflect what was going on at the time. And so, I mean, I still really like the song and I would never skip it or anything. So I would rather keep it faithful to what was happening at the time. And if that's, you know, if that describes the end of that journey the best way possible, then it should absolutely be there, and it's, you can't be any more legitimate than that.
So it's an album that marked a line in the sand for Metallica, and it quickly made them one of the biggest bands in the world, a title they still firmly hold today. Bob Rock said of Metallica and this landmark album, "The more and more I plunged into the world of Metallica, the more I came to understand that dealing with tough, scary, and not so pretty topics were things they were driven to explore." The band I got after this record was never the same, but I guess that's to be expected. They grew up, they became men, fathers and husbands. Being a Metallica was still vitally important to them, but when we did the Black Album, it was the only thing to them. I got them at just the right time. With that in mind, why does the Black Album stand the test of time for you?
I think it's just where the stars were aligning. I think whatever was going on in their lives has fueled this. And it's also the step up in musicianship, I suppose, songwriting, sounds, just everything. It just seemed to come together in the, and it's quite a magical moment when that happens. And you can't plan for that, really. It's a moment that happened, and it was managed to get captured on record. And, you know, you can't force these things. It's just one of those things. The stars aligned, I suppose.
And finally, why is the Black Album your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already? I mean, I'm not sure there's many people who haven't.
So for me, it sounds just as new and refreshing today as it did the first time I heard it. I still think it's one of the best, if not the best sounding heavy metal record ever recorded. I still think it sounds better than a lot of modern, you know, all these modern production techniques. And yeah, it never gets old. It's constantly in rotation on my playlist, and it's been a massive influence on my guitar playing and songwriting for Night Screamer. So yeah, I think if you haven't heard it for some reason, do yourself a favour.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, Calvin, thank you very much for joining me. We've talked a little bit about Night Screamer here and there. What's kind of going on for you guys at the moment? Have you got any tours planned? What's happening with you guys?
We've got a video, which is currently, we've done a little bit of shooting for a video for the song Night Screamer, which is off our debut album, Dead of Night, which came out about a month ago now. And so we've done a couple of gigs, and then we're going to be arranging a kind of special show for the launch of the video as a sort of single release. The album's doing well. We've had some good reviews and some really great feedback, and we've nearly sold out of all our physical copies.
Cool.
Which is great news. If you haven't checked it out, you can go to Bandcamp or our Facebook page and just do a Google search, and you can just stream it from Bandcamp, or, you know, you can purchase physical copies and whatnot. So check it out.
Awesome. Thank you very much for joining me. It's been, it's one of my favorite albums of all time. So I was very excited when you chose it.
Oh, well, yeah. It just had to be. So, I knew it would be. Well, there wasn't much deliberation in my mind of what I'd be talking about on this. So yeah, it's been great, and you've also educated me on some things I didn't know as well, which is awesome.
Special thanks to Calvin Lever there, who has taken time out of a very busy schedule with his band Night Screamer to sit down and chat with me about the Black Album by Metallica. And I think at this stage, Metallica are just so influential, they're just woven in the DNA of any heavy metal band. Night Screamer, I'm sure, would agree that, you know, especially with Calvin on guitar, that Metallica are a hugely influential band on their sound. Night Screamer are a mix of classic metal, hook-laden hard rock riffs, and 80s nostalgia, and their album, their debut album, Dead of Night, is out now. You can get it digitally on CD at nightscreamer.bandcamp.com, and they've got all sorts of merchandise and cool bundles there as well. So if you liked March of the Dead that we played early on there, you know, you're going to love this album. It's just a throwback in the best possible way. It's absolutely awesome. And yeah, I mean, I'll be keeping an eye out on Night Screamer from now on. Awesome band. Totally check them out. And that'll do it for another episode of My Classic Album. Thank you very much for joining me once again. We'll be having another episode in a couple of weeks' time with another classic album. So keep tuned to our social media pages to find out what that album will be and who's chosen it and who's appearing on the show. I've got two or three people that I'm kind of trying to arrange time to sit down with and to chat about their classic album. So if it's who I think it's going to be, anyone who has enjoyed this episode about the Black Album and that time in music, the early 90s, will particularly enjoy the next episode as well. That's if I get to that particular person first. It all just depends on who's free when and all that sort of thing. But keep your eyes out on our Facebook Instagram and Twitter pages, and of course at myclassicalbum.co.uk for all the latest information for upcoming episodes of My Classic Album. And I will see you in a couple of weeks. Cheers.